Hello and welcome to the third episode of Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening meant to encourage, empower, and educate local gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing local experts, garden enthusiasts, and local producers. While the name of this show is Homer Grown, we want to acknowledge the other communities that could consider this information applicable. Kasiloff, Ketchumek Silo, Hesketh Island, Fritz Creek, to name a few. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. Gardening is fascinating to me, and there is always something new to learn. Thank you for joining me for this episode. Today we will be talking about pollinators. The American naturalist E.O. Wilson said, "If all mankind were to disappear, the world would regenerate back to the rich state of equilibrium that existed 10,000 years ago. If insects were to vanish, the environment would collapse into chaos." While this may seem like a bleak statement, insects play a giant role in our world. Today we will be exploring insects and pollination. We talked to master gardener and author Brenda Adams about pollinator gardens. We chat with Matt Bowser, entomologist for the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. Kyra Wagner has our Tech Minute, where she tells us about how to repurpose a common household item to use for pollinating plants. We also hear from Catherine Shakey of Homer Soil and Water about the relationship between invasive plants and pollinators. And Pam Bowler from NRCS about how the NRCS, or National Resources Conservation Service, can assist local farmers with pollination programs. Let's get started. Can you please introduce yourself?
I'm Brenda Adams. I've lived in Homer for, 29 years now. I've gardened most of that time here, and I've been a member of the garden club. I am a master gardener. I have a garden design and build business called Gardens by Design, which has won 3 international design awards, so we're very proud of those. I've written 2 books published by the University of Alaska Press, one called There's a Moose in My Garden, that describes how to build and design a garden that takes advantage of the special features of gardening in Alaska. And then a companion book that came out second called Cool Plants for Cold Climates. Perfect for Alaska, but it also addresses the needs of people in Canada, the upper Midwest, New England, all cold climates around the world. So anything that's in our latitudes can use those books.
I actually have a copy of that book, and it is a gorgeous book.
Oh, thank you.
I took a class with you on pollinators, and in that you outlined 3 groups of pollinators in Alaska.
Okay, well, the 3 groups that we talked about in the class, we talked mostly about bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds. And those are the 3 main groups of pollinators, the big 3, if you will, even though we don't have tremendous number of hummingbirds on this side of the bay. There are a lot on the other side of the bay, on the south side. And depending on where you are and what you have in your garden, you may see some. But the most efficient pollinator that we have is bees. A pollinator is really anything that moves pollen from one plant to another. So that can be the wind. It can be an animal that brushes against a flower as it moves through a meadow. It can be a mosquito, even, as a pollinator. That's not one we intentionally try to attract, but they do move pollen from one place to another. We, as people walking through a meadow, will also do the same thing, or walking through your flower garden. But when we think about pollinators, most people think of bees first, and that's appropriate because they are the most efficient pollinator. But butterflies also do a lot of work in the garden in that regard, and then, of course, hummingbirds do. One thing about hummingbirds that's really interesting is their nests. Their nests are hard to spot sometimes because they're so tiny. and their eggs are really, really tiny, but you could hold a hummingbird nest in the end of your fingers. It's a really small nest, but they're beautifully constructed. And they gather all kinds of things to build their nest. They'll use dryer lint, you know, like they'll find the lint coming out of the vent from your dryer. They use spider webs. So if you have spider webs outside your house, leave them there because the hummingbirds will use them to hold their nest together. One of the joys of liking to have pollinators in your garden is it gives you permission to be a little messy and not have to always be a complete tidykins about everything. And it's really important, this is important, at the end of the season, leave the seed pods and the seed heads and things on your garden. Don't clean up in the fall because that will provide nesting material for all the pollinators, and it'll be there in the spring when the hummingbirds want to build their nests. They'll also use a lot of lichens. Their nests are just gorgeous. You go online and just Google hummingbird nests and you'll be amazed at how pretty they are. So it's good for all of the birds to leave the seed heads on your plants. And on your shrubs, like all the berries, leave all those things. The birds will, if they're not poisonous, the birds will strip them. It's good food for them when a lot of the native plants are all finished providing to them.
Have you encountered any hummingbirds here in Homer?
A couple, not very many. The only ones I've ever seen are a rufous, just still a pretty one. When I've gardened on the other side of the bay, when we've done some projects over there, I was really amazed at how many hummingbirds they have over there. They're zipping around all the time.
Could you give us just a couple examples of, let's say, what would attract bees or what plants would attract hummingbirds?
Well, if I may give you first a more general answer that will address all three groups and really will help to keep a healthy garden. To some extent, it's a philosophical way to garden. If you have diversity in your garden, diversity of color, flower shapes and sizes, different bloom times. It's very important for bees particularly to have things in bloom when the snow melts and still have things blooming when the snow comes back. So it's the two ends of the season when they need pollen from us and assist from us. But all living things need a water source as well, and as do these pollinators. They need a place for shelter and a place to raise their young. So in general, they need all those things, but they also need a healthy environment. When I talk about pollinators, I say never use pesticides, even organic ones, because they kill insects. BT is an organic pesticide that people talk about all the time and say, oh, well, it's organic, therefore it's assumed to be benign. My retort is arsenic is organic, you know, so we don't want to feed our kids arsenic. We don't want to feed caterpillars BT because caterpillars become butterflies. And yes, they may do damage to some of the foliage in your garden, but if you want butterflies, you have to let the caterpillars live. So no pesticides is my rule. If you have a healthy garden and you let the insect and natural creatures do their thing, they have a way of keeping themselves in balance. You start doing pesticides, you then kill a lot of the beneficial insects that will help you along the way. For example, you're trying to kill aphids. Well, in a greenhouse, I get that. That's a kind of an environment where aphids can go crazy in a really short period of time. But if you are vigilant and look at your greenhouse every day, if you see aphids, take that plant out of the greenhouse and wash it off with water and keep it out of the greenhouse for a few days, protect it. Keep treating it before you put it back in the greenhouse. I usually don't ever put a plant back in the greenhouse that I've found any amount of aphids on because I don't want to use pesticides in there. The interesting thing is that hummingbirds need protein, and one of the places they get it is aphids and spider mites. So, you know, these things all have a way of balancing out if we don't interfere too much, especially in an open-air garden when you're out in the garden itself.
So going back to the question, what are some specific plants that attract pollinators?
Some examples of plants that are good for bees and butterflies and butterfly larvae. And the larva is really important because without it, which is caterpillars, right? We don't get butterflies and we don't get moths. But some that do really well for all are yarrow, and I'll use common names. Monk's hood is another great one, and that's also a late blooming plant. The alliums, all of the alliums, whether it's a bulb or chive, those are good plants. columbines are great. They have a deep spur where the nectar is, and that attracts bees and butterflies. Butterflies have kind of a, it's hard to see it because they move around so much, but they have a fairly long proboscis. They can go deeply into a flower that is a funnel shape to get the nectar. And of course, so can hummingbirds. That's the point. Another really late blooming plant that is great for pollinators is aster. That's not one that I see around here that often, but it's a really good source of nectar late in the season. Butterfly bush, Buddleia, and well, crocuses are the early one. Coreopsis, that's or tick seed is the common name of that. That's another very late blooming plant. In fact, I've encouraged the nurseries to carry it because it's so late blooming, and they get frustrated with it because in the spring, it doesn't look like anything. When the nurseries were open, we tend to have a real short buying season here where everybody hits the nurseries about the last week of April to the last week of May. And Coreopsis doesn't look like much at that point in the season, but it's a beautiful late blooming plant. Delphiniums are another one. They're a little bit more maintenance than some people want, but they are a lovely late season bloomer. An early one is a shooting star. That's a native plant that's really nice. Draba is another native plant that's a real pretty little yellow, low-growing plant that's great for all of the pollinators. Fireweed, of course, we get that naturally. We don't have to do too much work for that, although there's a beautiful white fireweed that I really like. Hard to get, but geraniums, both are natives and some of the cultivars. And when I say geraniums, I'm talking about hardy geraniums, true geraniums, not the geraniums that we refer to as window box geraniums. That's a different genus altogether. Hosta is one that we think of as a foliage plant, but it has a tubular-shaped flower that is excellent for butterflies, and that's also a very late-blooming plant in our climate anyway. Daisies are wonderful for all of them, although that blooms in the midsummer. And bee balm. Bee balm is Monarda. That's a great plant for all of the pollinators. Catmint. Bees are attracted and butterflies are attracted to minty scents. And so catmint is not catnip, but catmint. And that's a really great one. Forget-me-nots. Bees love forget-me-nots, our state flower. So there are a number of them. Penstemon is, or beard tongue is the common name of that. That's also a fairly late bloomer. But shooting stars that I just mentioned is also a very early bloomer, and that is helpful for the pollinators. Roses are native rose. You'll see bees on that a lot. It's got a lot of nectar in it, not just pollen. So they all need nectar as well as pollen. Many of the herbs are really wonderful attractors for pollinators. And some of them, especially the stronger scented ones, are deterrents to some of the pests that we have, like mosquitoes. They don't tend to like the strongly scented herbs, like rosemary or lavender or sage. Those kinds of things tend to be deterrents to pest bugs. So, you know, there are just a lot of ways that you can go.
You mentioned calendula. Right. We use calendula to keep pest away from our cabbages and our brassicas.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's a great thing to do, and it adds a lot of beautiful color to your garden. I really like those. Yeah, I like to eat them too, though.
Mm-hmm. You want to have plants that are early season and late season. Mm-hmm. What's some examples of the first blooming plants and the later season plants?
Well, the earliest plants that we can get to bloom in a garden will be fall planted spring blooming bulbs. And some of the really early ones are crocuses. I think most people know what a crocus looks like. My crocuses start to bloom while the snow is still fading from the garden, and they are just covered in bees. But there are a lot of other really lovely little bulbs that come after that. One's called Chionodoxa. What's the common name for Chionodoxa? Glory of the snow. Glory of the snow. So that tells you it's an early one as well. Grape hyacinths, a lot of people enjoy those cute little blue, look like little tiny berries all together in a clump, like a hyacinth, but in miniature. All of those will bloom extremely early, and then they'll follow on with daffodils. They're all hardy bulbs for us. They will come back year after year if you give them good drainage, and they will multiply. And they're there as soon as the snow melts. And that's what the bees that are coming out of hibernation, our native bees come out of hibernation for the most part. Birds have just made a long trip from somewhere. They are really in need of nourishment. And our native plants don't start blooming as early bulbs. There are some annuals that if you can get them going early, that will be really helpful to get that early blossom, even if you don't want to have an in-ground garden, if you just are gardening in containers. Getting those annuals that, you know, you can force in from the nursery or in your own greenhouse, you know, get them out for the pollinators. Toward the end of the season, there are a lot of late-blooming plants that we can grow. A bee balm is a really good pollinator plant. Monarda is the genus of that. But bee balm is a nice late bloomer. A lot of the veronicas bloom late, but veronica is a good one. Some of the salvias are fairly late. So those are a couple of examples. There are also some native plants that bloom fairly late, like fireweed. If you have a meadow that has fireweed in it, keep that meadow. And especially if you have lupin. Lupin provides all three of the big pollinators support. It's great for bees. It's great for butterflies as well as for hummingbirds. They all will sup from it. But it's not a good plant to put in a groomed garden because it keeps traveling around, but it's wonderful in a wild spot.
You mean it spreads?
It spreads, yes.
Kind of touched on this a little bit before, but what can a gardener do in order to establish a welcoming habitat for pollinators?
A welcoming habitat is one that's free of pesticides, and it has lots of different color. Bees are more drawn to whites and blues and kind of the softer colors, whereas butterflies are attracted more to reds and pinks and more vibrant, warmer colors. But you'll see them both on all colors. Rather than making it too complicated and saying you have to have this color to attract this kind of pollinator, my suggestion is just have a lot of diversity. The colors that you like, as long as they are healthy flowers, pollinators will come. It helps if you have different shapes and sizes. For example, butterflies, you'll find them on plants that have a flat flower form, like a daisy or yarrow, where it has a flat surface where they can land and sit there, you know, stand there, I guess they really are doing, and they can then get nectar and pollen from a number of different flowers on that cluster. Things that are ground covers that are in a large mass, like the thymes right now that are blooming all over town, thyme is a wonderful attractor for bees, so you'll just see them massing on it. And that's whether there are native bees or honeybees. There are a lot of people that have hives around town, and so you'll see honeybees some too. But the thymes are great because they're in big patches. So a big patch of any kind of flower that's, like, say, 4 by 4 feet, if you have a big enough garden to accommodate that, that makes the gathering of pollen and nectar more efficient for the pollinator because they don't have to fly so much between flowers. I'm sure you've heard or read the story that it's not possible for a bee to fly. Aerodynamically, people can't quite figure out how they can fly. It doesn't make any sense. So if you talk to an aeronautical engineer, they'll say, good grief, how does this thing fly? But they do, obviously. But it takes a lot of energy for them to fly.
It's their work ethic.
Yeah, maybe.
For your own personal garden, are there certain plants that you have intentionally planted or your favorite plants?
Well, I intentionally plant lots of bulbs. The early spring is one of my favorite times in my garden because they are covered with all the different bulbs. And they'll start literally when the snow melts and I still have bulbs blooming. So it's a really nice long season of bulbs. And I do that intentionally for the pollinators, but I do it also because I love them. And they're really easy and they're fun to pick for a bouquet, especially when the daffodils start to bloom. I love to have a vase of daffodils. But I follow my own advice in that I have a ton of different kinds of plants in my garden. I probably have more than 1,000 different genuses of plants in my gardens. So there's tons of diversity there. I have some favorite plants just because I like them. One of them is Astrantia, and I like it because it starts blooming July 4th and it blooms until Labor Day, so it blooms for a long time. It's a great cut flower. It'll last for 2 weeks in a vase, and you can dry it in the fall and keep it all winter long in a dry vase as a fall arrangement.
Okay. Are there any tricks to draw pollinators into a high tunnel or a greenhouse?
Well, I've not ever personally gardened in a high tunnel, so I'm certainly not expert on that. But in my greenhouse, I just leave the door open. When I first had a greenhouse, I kept thinking I need to have screens on everything. I need to keep every little crack covered so that aphids don't come in. The truth is aphids will find a way in no matter what, but by covering everything, the bees didn't come in. So I just leave the door of my greenhouse open and pollinators can fly in and out as they want. I've got squash in the greenhouse right now and they're doing a great job of pollinating that. There are a lot of flowers that, just annual flowers that are fun and simple that you can put in your greenhouse or your high tunnel to attract them. Like calendula is a wonderful one, really bright, vibrant colors. You can put it in, cut one off and break the petals apart and put it in a salad. And nasturtiums are another one. They're delicious. They've got a really nice spicy flavor. And I would think putting a couple of those in a high tunnel would attract pollinators in. Anything that has got a lot of nectar and a lot of pollen, especially spicy scents, seem to draw bees and butterflies. I don't know if you know this, but hummingbirds don't have a sense of smell. So you attract hummingbirds with color. You don't want your hummingbirds coming into a greenhouse anyway, but they don't smell. Butterflies and bees do, and they like minty smells, which I think is one of the reasons they're so attracted to thyme. That's got kind of a little bit of a minty scent.
Before we started recording, you'd mentioned a fact about the number of bee species in Alaska.
There are at least 95 species of native bees in Alaska. And I say at least because it's such a big state and there's so many areas of it that are uncharted that there are probably species we don't know about. There are about 75 species of butterflies that are native to Alaska. So we have quite a few. Now, it's a much smaller piece of the whole pie because in the greater United States, there are over 4,000 species of bees. But we have 95 of them. And I think it's 15 or 16 of them are bumblebees. Or bombus, which is kind of a fun word to say, bombus. But speaking of bees, one of the other things you can do to help them that I didn't mention is to leave some areas of the ground open. We have a lot of our bees are ground dwellers, and so they need dirt to get to and mud. And so if you don't totally manicure everything, it will help them. Let them have some muddy areas. And mud is also good for butterflies. They will do a thing called puddling. If you have a wet area, you'll see butterflies all sitting on it. And they're drinking, but they're also getting some micronutrients from the soil that they need. And water source is important. And we do bird baths and stuff for the birds. For bees, you need to have a water source that is shallow, that they can walk into and walk out of. Once they get wet, they can't fly. So making sure that there's an entrance or exit ramp, more importantly, for them to get out of the water. So a water source for all of them is a good thing to include. Also, some of our bees nest in wood, and you can build little nesting houses for them. It's best if you use tubes that you can remove and replace annually so that they don't build up any kind of fungus or bacteria or any kind of a buildup. Our bees are Many of them are called solitary, which doesn't mean that they live alone. It means that they only tend their own young. There'll be multiple solitary bees in a given nest. They just only mind their own young, whereas our bumblebees are community livers, and they do mind each other's young, just like honeybees do.
Speaking of solitary bees, do you have any experience with mason bees?
We have mason bees in Alaska, but why do you ask? I'm curious.
I've tried keeping mason bees 1 year, and I don't think I had any success with them. So I've been just asking everyone that to try to figure out how these mason bees work.
Right. For a garden, if you have a variety of plants in a garden, whether it's vegetables or ornamentals, our native bees are going to be better pollinators for a general purpose garden. Honeybees are what's called a monocropper, and that means that they just go after one kind of flower at a time. That's why you can get fireweed honey, because when they go out to the fireweed, they're just gathering nectar from the fireweed. Whereas our native bees, they're very opportunistic and they will visit any kind of flower that attracts them. In terms of pollinating a garden, I prefer to have native bees, but honeybees, of course, are very well suited to agriculture because a lot of farms have a big field of one crop. And so having honeybees will be very suitable to that. Anything else that you want to ask about? I mean, I think we covered a lot of ground.
I think so, too.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was author and master gardener Brenda Adams talking with me on June 25th, 2020. Up next, Kyra Wagner has your Tech Minute.
Hello, this is Kyra Wagner with your Tech Minute. Now remember, technology doesn't have to be super fancy or advanced, and when it comes to indoor pollination of your vegetables and fruit trees, sometimes the technology is actually quite basic, but everything needs to be pollinated. So for example, when you get started off with your squash and all those beautiful blooms, you want your pumpkins and squash to develop, you will need to take something to get that pollen from the male flowers to the female flowers. One of the best ways is simply to use a Q-tip. That's not high-tech advanced kind of technology, but it does work. If you want more help and don't think that you can do it all, bring in some animal power. Farmers have always used animal power, whether it was to pull their plow or to pollinate their crops. So if you have a nice sealed-up high tunnel, and yet your fruit trees are blooming, you may want to consider bringing in some mason bees. A lot of people in the area have ordered different kinds of bumblebees to fly around and pollinate their crops. Another interesting trick I've heard of, smelled really, is to bring in something like a dead fish or maybe a bucket of decaying compost so that your flies develop and end up flying around your high tunnel or your greenhouse and pollinating all your crops. Flies are the truly underestimated pollinators in our area. But if you keep a nice, tight, clean greenhouse and it's full of beautiful tomatoes, you won't have any tomato plants that produce tomatoes if you don't get those pollinated. So tomatoes with their tiny little flowers need some kind of vibration, like a bumblebee landing on them and pollinating them. One way to mimic this is with a high-tech version of an electric toothbrush. Nothing manages to match the vibration of a bumblebee better than the vibration of an electric toothbrush. But you can also resort to just shaking your tomatoes with your own hand. They'll still comply. So good luck pollinating. This has been Kyra Wagner with your Tech Minute.
Hi, this is Catherine Shakey with Homer Soil and Water. I am here just to talk about our native pollinators and invasive plants. So one of the important things to keep in mind is that our native insects that pollinate our native plants, mostly fly species and some bumblebees, really depend on pollen for protein and nectar for sugar throughout the entire summer. So if all the flowers bloomed only in June, then these insects would starve in July and August. One of the great things about our native intact ecosystems is that we have composition of flowering plants, shrubs, and trees that bloom throughout the entire summer. So that's critical for maintaining diverse insect populations, which are fed by diverse plant populations. Now, those insects are not just pollinators, but they also become food for birds, fish, and small mammals. One of the problems with invasive plants is that they create a monoculture of a single species of plant, which will bloom all at once. By decreasing the native composition of flowers and shrubs and trees, this means that there's just less food for the pollinators throughout the year. They risk starving in the other months once that invasive plant has passed. The other problem with invasive plants is that they disrupt pollinator habits. So there are some studies that have come out of UAF in Fairbanks around 2013 through 2015 by Dr. Katie Spellman and others that looked at specifically white sweet clover, which is Melilotus alba. So that's an invasive plant, a very tall plant, and it produces a lot of nectar and it has a very strong scent, which is attractive to our pollinators. Now, it actually distracts the pollinators from the native vegetation and ensures that this invasive white sweet clover gets pollinated. That plant can produce about 350,000 seeds per plant, so it really outcompetes native vegetation pretty fast. In these UAF studies, they actually found that in bogs and muskeg areas where invasive white sweet clover gets established, the pollinators have been disrupted enough that it changes the berry setting and pollination of native cranberries and blueberries. So those invasive plants really threaten our native populations of not just plants, but in turn, pollinators, which are food for the other animals in our ecosystem and the trophic food web.
That was Catherine Shakey from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Coming up next, I talk to entomologist for the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, Matt Bowser, on June 24th, 2020. And a note to the listeners, we recorded this remotely, so you might hear a few technical glitches. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Matt Bowser. I serve as entomologist at Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. Been there since 2004. I do mostly kind of biodiversity work for the refuge, insects and other things, a lot of botany work. I also am a gardener. My family and I have two high tunnels, so we deal with pollinators there also. That's my background in relation to this.
To clarify, what does biodiversity mean?
That's just one simple broad term for covering all the variation that's out there in the biological world. It's also genetic diversity too. It can be population level or looking even within a population, the genetics of individuals. That's kind of the broader definition of biodiversity. And that's also the definition I work under. The Kenai Refuge, as with other Alaska National Wildlife Refuges, has among its founding documents, one of its main purposes is to conserve natural diversity. It's ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, that established the refuge as it is.
My first question for you is, why is pollination so important?
It's a real general question, really. It goes back to why sexual mating systems exist in the first place. So why they're advantageous for a lot of the more complex organisms that are out there. You know, why that's important. And a lot of it has to do with adaptation or adaptability. If you're a clonal organism like dandelions are mostly clonal now, then you're kind of in a dead end where if there are any errors in that genome, you know, like a cancer is a good example of a genetic error that we deal with. Any other genetic defect, like the genes that cause weeping willows to weep or those kind of weeping birches to weep, that's a defective gene. If you're a clonal organism that doesn't share genetic information, then you're stuck with that broken gene. And even if you have a bunch of perfectly good genes, if the environment changes, then your progeny, your offspring, they're going to be just like you genetically. So they're not going to be able to adapt. So generally, those sexual systems allow exchange of genetic information. So you can mix genetic information and have a lot of variation out there so that at least some of your progeny will likely be adapted to whatever conditions that might arise. That's the broader reason why. But with plants, can't move around very well on their own. Their best way of dealing with that is to send pollen around. So that's why, you know, pollination is important. To measure how important it is you can do it kind of like an economist, where you would measure how important something is, like how important a TV is to someone by how much a person will pay for it. Similarly, with plants or with organisms in general, you can see that they invest a whole lot in sending pollen around. Right here in Kasiloff this spring, this was a big year for spruce pollen and probably for some of the other, it seems like there's a lot of aspen also this year. Trees are producing a lot more than usual. These wind-pollinated plants like spruce, they have to produce a whole lot of pollen, which is expensive to do. But they have to do it because the chance of any one pollen grain making it to another tree is pretty small. To make it to a female cone on a spruce tree, there has to be a lot of spruce trees around and trees have to make a lot of pollen in order for it to work.
What are some native pollinators?
So around here it's mostly insects, and the other big groups of pollinators around the world are bats and hummingbirds. And we do have hummingbirds and hummingbird pollinated plants here, but the majority of our plants in this area are either insect pollinated or wind pollinated. Todd Eskelin, who I work with, he bans hummingbirds. I know we've got at least the ruby-throated, I think is the right name, and the Anna's. I know Anna's is right. But I think there's a third also that showed up in Seward, but that's a better question for a birder.
So what kind of insects are we talking about?
We have a number of kinds of bees, but especially bumblebees. We have several species of bumblebees around, and they're excellent pollinators of a real wide variety of plants, and some plants are only bumblebee pollinated. But then we also have leafcutter bees and masked bees, and we have wasps, and up north we have a lot of flies that are pollinators, so it's, you know, really quite a few flies that are out there. And if you go on to individual flowers, you'll see a lot of what's on flowers are flies. They may not be as efficient of a pollinator in terms of they don't carry pollen well, they don't have the combs, the hairs to carry the pollen as well, but there are so many of them that they effectively are good pollinators here. There are lots of mussel flies that are kind of like or related to house flies, and especially flower flies or hover flies. They're the same thing, flower flies, hover flies. There's two names for them. But those are the ones you'll see around that are black and yellow striped. They look a lot like wasps. They're mimicking wasps. If you go around and look at flowers around where you are, you'll see quite a few of these black and yellow flies, and those are syrphid, also known as hover flies or flower flies.
The hover flies mimic wasps based on their appearance. Do they mimic them in any other aspects?
You know, I haven't seen them really do that. No, there are some insects that'll do that. They'll pretend to be stinging wasps, even in behavior. But the syrphid flies don't tend to do that as much. Yeah, there's some. There's a clearwing moth that we have here. That it's a moth, but it has most of the cells in the wings are clear of the scales that usually give moths their color, and they look at first glance just like a bumblebee, and they really do act like a bumblebee in the way that they fly around, and you'd mistake them for a bumblebee if you weren't looking closely. They're good mimics.
My next question. So where I grew up in Virginia, there's a plant called yucca, and the plant's pollination is dependent solely on one insect, which is the yucca moth. This moth has evolved with the yucca plant. It lays its eggs in the plant, and it uses mouth parts that are used specifically to pollinate this plant. My question is, are there any Alaskan plants that are dependent solely on one pollinator?
You know, not as tightly as the yucca moth. That's a really famous example. But there are some here that are somewhat specialized, and it's only a few pollinators that can pollinate them, but not a one-to-one, you know, single species, one pollinator and one host plant. So some of our louseworts, for example, are only bumblebee pollinated. They're real pretty alpine plants. There's some in the lowlands too. They're one that's fairly specialized, but as far as I know, we don't have any that are as specialized as the yucca moth and the yucca plant.
Or none that have co-evolved together.
Well, then you have to be an evolutionist. But we do have some that we say that are that way, like the pedicularis, that's the lousewort. But it's to specializing with Bombus anyway, with bumblebees. Again, not to the same degree, not to a single species, but to just a narrow group.
What are some threats to a healthy insect population?
Well, some of the big ones worldwide right now, you know, there's some big papers on insect declines that have come out in the last decade, really the last few years. And it's what we think what's going on worldwide is habitat destruction and pesticide use, a number of things put together that have caused those big declines, the kind of the scary declines. We haven't seen that up here. Part of it is that we don't have the kind of data. You'd have to have long-term information of insect abundance, which is very hard to get in order to really say something about that. But even in some cases where we might suspect some of what we're concerned about, like the western bumblebee that's declined in a lot of western North America, we haven't seen that in Alaska. It's still quite common. So here the threats are a little different because there's not as much development in Alaska. Our bigger concerns are climate change and invasive species. We've seen some change due to invasive species, but not anything measurable as far as effects on native species of pollinators. Not very easy to say how, you know, exactly what's going to happen or how that's changing so far.
I'm wondering if you know of any invasive insects.
Oh yeah, there are quite a few, and I don't have a complete list, but we just published a list of the non-native insects of Alaska, along with a list of the non-native species of the United States. Derek Sykes at UAM and I were involved in that, so I won't remember all those, but some that are conspicuous here. Well, in Homer, the spruce aphid is really notable, and that's one that's climate-related. So it was introduced, it's a European species. We saw it first in Alaska in the 60s or 70s in Southeast, and it's been making its way up here, and it's probably been showing up in Homer for a while, but because Homer's too cold, it hasn't been able to make it. But then we had a run of warm winters, and that's what really matters for the spruce aphids, and they really took off. So you saw the damage there, I'm sure, in Homer. on spruce trees.
To clarify, this is different than the spruce bark beetle?
So spruce aphid feeds on the needles. It's mostly in the winter that it's active. It's feeding on the leaves, sucking the juices out of the leaves. But then spruce bark beetle is a native beetle. It's been here as probably as long as the spruce have. And it feeds under the bark in the cambium. That's the phloem tissue of the living tissue of the bole of the tree. And they effectively girdle the tree. Very different animal. It's a beetle. It's native. Spruce trees are adapted to dealing with them. As far as we know, these cycles of spruce beetle kill and spruce kind of recovering has been going on for a long time, at least hundreds of years based on tree ring data. But then as far as invasives seen in recent years, green alder sawfly, you know, that's something that you didn't hear about before 2000. And same with the birch leaf miners. We've got three species of non-native birch leaf miners that have kind of exploded in Southeast Alaska, but then they've also declined. And then in the Homer area, one that's new is just a few years ago, we found cluster flies, which tend to be, they're not really, as far as we know, economically important, but they're a nuisance. They show up in your house a lot in the spring, big hairy flies. There are tons of them in Homer now. It's a great place to see cluster flies. Before, I think it was 2015, none had been found in Alaska. So that's a new one.
So what are some more detrimental insects that have parasitic relationships to native plants and animals?
You know, there are a lot. I mean, but first I would like to, I'd say that, you know, I don't really like to characterize things as good or bad. That's the judgment call. It's pretty arbitrary in a lot of ways when you look at it. But there are many. A lot of insects are closely related or have tight relationships with plants and animals around here too, but plants especially. So an example of plants are the willow rose galls that you'll see around. Have you seen those?
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So it looks like a rose, but it's formed out of willow leaves. It's caused by a tiny little fly that lays an egg on a growing stem, and the little larva will cause the stem to not elongate. So all the leaves that would have been on that stem will now be wrapped around it in this little rosette, like a rose. I mean, it makes a little home for that larva to grow in. So it's one example of many. There are many, many, you know, very tight relationships. Those rose galls are, you know, harmful to the plant. The plant doesn't grow as much. That stem, with few exceptions, is not going to develop or elongate. It's a dead end for that plant. So it's growth that it's lost. But then another example of a real tight relationship here is a moose fly. It's a fly that's a big, hairy, orangey-brown fly that normally you won't see because it doesn't mess with people, but they breed in moose dung. The larvae grow and eat moose dung, but then the adults feed on moose blood. They're parasites, kind of like a mosquito is for us, but they're very specific to only moose. So that's an animal that its whole life cycle is dependent on a moose. I think the moose would say that they're detrimental. They don't like them.
We had these flies that I had never seen before when we had pigs that really loved the pig poop. But the way that you were describing, at least the physical description, sounded very similar.
Yeah, those might have been, there's probably some kind of scathophagid, which the Latin name means scat is poop, and I don't know the Greek root, but phagy is to eat. They're poop-eating flies. So we get a lot of those on horse manure, for example. They're greenish-yellow, dingy flies that are on a lot of different kinds of manure. But those ones, in contrast to the moose flies, they're kind of beneficial. The adults will eat these manure flies. I think it's called the yellow dung fly. They'll actually eat black flies and such that we don't like so much.
Do you know what the bird in the background is?
No, I wish I did. I keep meaning to be a better birder than I am. But there are so many insects, I don't get to the birds.
To me, insects actually are more interesting.
Well, they are. Well, birds are fascinating animals, but we know so much more about them compared to insects. What attracts me to insects is that you can literally go in your backyard and find an insect that's undescribed, that's new to science, and nobody knows what it does. You might have a good guess, but that's really appealing. You don't have to go very far at all or have fancy equipment. I really like that.
For me, the interest is how alien they seem.
Yes, they're very different creatures. So they work more like some kind of robot or machine as far as they have more predictable behavior. They're simpler organisms. And it really gets interesting when you, sounds more boring, but when you get into anatomy and physiology, it's really neat to see how these little animals have all the major systems that we do, to do all the things that our bodies need to do. And you think about the human body, which is more complicated, But these little animals in the big world and do all the things that we do. You know, they have to go fly around, find food, find mates, reproduce, do all that. And they're such small, comparatively simple organisms. They're neat, but very different ways of doing things.
Do a lot of insects have a hierarchy or a colony? I know honeybees, and I know that they have, you know, a certain hierarchy, the queen, the drones, and the workers. Are a lot of insects that you encounter, are they social insects?
Most are not. There are only a few social groups out there. They're really just the ants and the bees, several groups of bees, some wasps, and termites that are what they call eusocial, where they're highly social organisms. And they are some of the most fascinating insects to study because you'll see all kinds of really fascinating behaviors, even among pollinators. So that's kind of biased. European honeybees are really neat. They have the best, as far as we know, the most complicated communication in the insect world. It's neat. The waggle dance is really something. But honeybees are really predictable in their social behavior, a very set system, where if you look at the yellow jackets, for example, they're a lot more dynamic, where the queen is more likely to be usurped by another queen. There are all kinds of things that happen with them. So you can have, there are special yellow jackets that never raise their own young. They just go take over. They assassinate queens of other colonies and have all the other workers raise their own young. And you'll see in ants, you'll see all kinds of variation. And you'll see, we have slave making ants here in Alaska that they're pretty neat. So you'll see a colony of ants and you look at them and it looks like, hey, there are two kinds of ants here in the same colony. And it's really what's going on. You have ants that will go capture ants, immature ants from other colonies. They'll go steal the pupae from another colony that will then become adults and think they're part of the colony of the slave making ants. So there's all kinds of neat things that go on with the social insects. They're fun to look at.
Is that called kleptoparasites?
Yeah, those are the ones that, if I'm remembering it right, those are the ones that have others raise their brood. So there are cuckoo bumblebees, for example. I think that's right. I have to look that up to make sure. Yeah, like cuckoo bumblebees will do what I described for some yellow jackets. They'll go assassinate a queen and have of another species and have those workers raise her young.
So I just have one more question on my list. Certain salmon eat insects. Which insects are important to a healthy salmon ecosystem?
Sure. So as you indicated, it's not all salmon that rely on insects so much. It's especially silvers, the cohos that spend a lot of time in freshwater, are voracious insectivores. But they really are generalists. They'll eat any insect that they get that they can find. They'll eat varying in size or other invertebrates. So it was found in, I think, the Anchor River that little juvenile cohos were eating earthworms. So non-native earthworms were an important part of their diet there. But they're opportunists. They'll eat whatever insects they can get. So it's almost more important that there are plenty of insects. That might be more important than what kind they are for a coho. They'll eat aquatic insects and terrestrial insects that end up in the water, that fall into the water. So they don't key in on a particular insect so much. They eat lots of different kinds of insects.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I might have missed?
Yeah, I guess along with the ethics part is try to learn what you've got. Don't just go smushing things because you think it might be a problem, because you know, most of the insects you're going to run across, like in my high tunnels, for example, most of them are there either accidentally or they're at least not harmful. So there are some, when I learn about them, that I try to kill them because I know they're eating my crops. I think, and that's true with pollinators too. I think there's a lot out there, and just having a diverse landscape, I think, is more important than trying to make a particular pollinator garden for any particular thing. I guess that's all I would say.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Matt Bowser, entomologist for the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. Coming up next, we talked to Pam Voller from our local NRCS office.
I'm Pam Voller. I work for the Natural Resources Conservation Service in Homer. I'm a soil conservationist and the district conservationist. So here in NRCS, we offer technical and financial assistance to farmers We offer it whether you farm 1,000 acres or less than 1 acre. In fact, most of the farmers that we work with on the peninsula are small-scale growers who produce flowers or food for sale or simply just provide food for their families. We offer conservation planning assistance and can help identify natural resource needs on your operation, including pollinator habitat. The way we support pollinators is by working with private landowners to create habitat on their working lands that provides food and sanctuary for pollinators. We often think in terms of planting flowering plants to provide food for pollinators, but habitat needs also include protective cover, places to lay and overwinter eggs, as well as nesting sites. NRCS incorporates pollinators into conservation planning with practices such as hedgerows, cover crops, and field borders. For instance, if you had a crop field with runoff that was carrying excess nutrients or sediments off the field, and you wanted to treat that with a field border, you could plant a swath of grass, or you could plant a multi-species swath of perennials that provide pollinator habitat instead. NRCS encourages the use of native plant species, usually perennials, in pollinator planting. Some seeds can be a challenge to find, however, but Karen in our office has just searched to see which seeds a person could likely find, and among those are the native goldenrod, columbine, northern sweet vetch, yarrow, Jacob's ladder, and wild geranium. But when you go looking for seeds, it's very important to know the entire name of the plant you want, that is the genus and the species, because there are instances where one species in a desired genus may be invasive, whereas the other one is a native and works perfectly well here. Lupin is a common one that people run into. So if you have some plants in mind and you want to check them out and research them, you can go to one site called plants.gov, that's plants.gov, and you can look up the species you're interested in, and as part of the description, it will let you know if it's native or introduced or invasive in Alaska. Actually, anywhere in the U.S., but it does include Alaska as well. So all the plants I mentioned previously are forbs, but we actually have some really easily propagated willows. For example, scholar's willow, which is common here, and you can go out and just grab a live cutting and put it in the ground, and it will likely grow for you. And it's an early bloomer. It's a good source of pollen and nectar in the spring when there aren't many other flowers available. Plus, beyond being a good food source, many willows host to larval butterflies and moths. And one last point, Alaska is fortunate to have healthy populations of pollinators. So rather than importing pollinators, and here I'm not talking about honeybees, we have nothing that can provide the services they provide, but if you're thinking of importing pollinators, bumblebees or something to help around your place, you also, with importing them, include a risk of bringing in some disease. So I would encourage people to create or maintain or improve habitat that will support our native pollinators.
Hi, I'm Nicola Revelo from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. Stoked Beekeeping Company is open to providing pollination services to local commercial fruit and pollinator crop growers. Contact James by email at stokedbeekeeping@gmail.com. A new farmer's market in Anchor Point opened for the 2020 season at the Cheeky Moose on the Sterling Highway near the North Fork intersection. This is the second season the Cheeky Moose will host the market, which is open every Thursday afternoon from at least noon to 5 p.m. Booth space is open to local farms, cottage food, and handmade craft vendors. There is no booth fee, and hours on Thursdays can be flexible. Bring your own tent and booth setup, as this market is located out in the parking lot in front of the business. All Southern Kenai Peninsula producers are welcome. Contact Robin at the Cheeky Moose to learn more about becoming a vendor, or stop by to check it out on Thursdays. Another midweek local food shopping opportunity, the Homer Farmers Market's Wednesday markets are starting July 1st for the 2020 season. You can now visit the market twice a week on Wednesdays from 2 to 5 and on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3. And lastly, The Kenai Peninsula District Office of the UAF Cooperative Extension is testing pressure canner gauges by appointment. Their office is located in Soldotna. Contact Linda Tannehill to make an appointment. Email LK Tannehill, that's LKTANNEHILL, at alaska.edu.
You ready?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah?
Here we go.
That about does it for this episode. Thank you for tuning in. I want to thank author Brenda Adams for talking to us about pollinator gardens, as well as Matt Bowser, who talked to us about native insects. Thanks to Pam Voller from the local NRCS office. Big shout out and thanks to Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, who contribute so much to every episode. The show was produced at the KBBI studios in beautiful downtown Homer. I also want to give a special thanks to Dave Erickson and Dave Shorer, who sat down for an interview with me about pollinators and fruit trees. There was so much information that I could not possibly include it into this episode, and made an executive decision to feature them on a future episode. Perhaps you have noticed the old-timey music in the background. That is performed by local musicians Carly Connemack and Kevin Cope. You can hear this show again in another 2 weeks. The topic will be peonies. Any feedback or questions for an upcoming show can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.
Well, I guess we have solved the world's problems here.
Maybe in a small way.
In a small way.